The United States did everything in its power to undermine the distribution of the original version of Iraq's 12,000-page document to the UN on its weapons of mass destruction programs. Ultimately, the U.S. grabbed the document and cut thousands of pages out before making it available to other members of the Security Council. And the U.S. had good reasons for hijacking this sensitive document. The 12,000-page report to the UN Security Council lists some 150 foreign companies, including dozens of companies from the U.S., Britain, Germany, and France that supported Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction program. Today on Flashpoints, we continue our reporting on this very important story, on the key role played by the U.S. and the West in arming Iraq. Flashpoints first began reporting this story in 1997 with an extensive joint investigation with the San Francisco Bay Guardian called Made in America, which was recognized by Project Censored in 1998. The latest incarnation comes to us as a result of the good reporting of Andrea Sumach, a reporter with the German newspaper. He joins us from his offices in Geneva. Andre Sumach, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me on.
Good to have you. Well, first of all, give us some background. Tell us something about what it looked like in its original incarnation and how it disappeared and then reappeared.
Well, the original incarnation, 11,807 pages divided up into four chapters: Nuclear Weapons Cooperation, Biological Weapons Cooperation, Chemical Weapons Cooperation, and Cooperation on Missile Technology. It arrived in the U.S. on December the 8th, Sunday afternoon, one full copy, and the original decision by the Security Council 2 days before December 6th was that only those pages should be cut off that might contain construction plans for nuclear weapons. Those should not fall into the hand of the 10 non-nuclear members of the Security Council in order to avoid proliferation of nuclear weapons knowledge. But everything else was supposed to be handed out to all 15 members of the Council at the same time, the same identical copies. And then the U.S. snatched the complete copy Sunday night, took it away to Washington for 24 hours, and then made the copies for the other four permanent members, Russia, China, Great Britain, and France. We still cannot be 100% sure that those four permanent members actually got exactly the identical version the U.S. has. One might assume that, but we cannot be sure, because in 26 hours of exclusive possession, there was all time and opportunity to maybe make certain changes, cut out certain sensitive information, etc. But what is certainly more important is, on the way to the 10 non-permanent members, about more than two-thirds of the whole copy was censored, because the non-permanent members only got roughly 3,500 pages. Not only the nuclear weapons building blueprints were cut out, but all information about foreign suppliers, be it companies, governments, weapon laboratories, to Saddam Hussein's program of weapons and mass destruction.
So essentially, the U.S. government, the CIA, whoever, took out approximately 8,000 pages of the original document.
Yes, that's correct. Approximately 8,000 pages, yeah.
It's crucial, of course, to know what these Security Council members got, because the United States is already talking about a material breach by Iraq based on what's missing from the report. And how would we know what's missing from the report or what validity to give to the Secretary of State when we don't know what the other members got?
That's exactly the problem the non-permanent members do have. Some of them came out public, like Syria, making exactly this point. How should and could they possibly pass on a political judgment on the content of the whole report and pass on a judgment on whether or not Baghdad has fulfilled the obligation under Security Council Resolution 1441 if they don't have two-thirds of the copy? Unfortunately, I should say most of the other non-permanent members have given up on whatever opposition or critique they might have had in the beginning. Some, like the Mexicans, did it under heavy U.S. pressures. Others, especially those who leave the Council by the end of this month, you know, there is a turnaround and five new non-permanent members come in. Those who leave might have thought it's not worth the effort and the time anymore to get into a conflict with the U.S. Anyway, the problem is that, as of now, nobody really seems to make an issue out of that anymore, except for the Syrians, and it looks like the 10 non-permanent members of the Council will never really get the full truth. And this puts a lot of doubt and question about all the future decisions this council might make in the next few weeks, possibly about a new Security Council resolution, maybe mandating a war against Iraq. So we always will wonder what is really the basis of knowledge and facts on which these decisions are going to be taken.
Now, in terms of what's missing before we get into the arming of Iraq, are we sure that part of what's missing are these documents that implicate the U.S. and the West in arming Iraq?
Yes, I'm very sure because I talked to diplomats of several non-permanent members of the Council, checked with them, and they all assured me that in their copies of roughly 3,500 pages, there's not a single information about foreign suppliers, be it companies, weapon laboratories, or governments, or individual persons.
That's the voice of Andreas Zumach. He is a reporter with the German newspaper Die Tage Zeitung, and that newspaper broke the story about the United States essentially hijacking the document and then altering it, if you will. And we're going to talk about the significance of the altering of the document when it comes to dealing with corporations that arm the world with weapons of mass destruction. I know, Andreas Zumach, you have been on this story from the very beginning. Give us some background on what you knew and what many people knew, journalists should have known if they didn't know, and when they knew it.
Well, the overall political picture is that after the toppling of the dictatorship in Iran, in the capital city of Tehran in 1979, a very bloody dictatorship by the Shah of Persia, who was supported by the U.S. and by all the Western European countries because he had cheap oil. After he was toppled by what then was an Islamic revolution, Iran was being perceived as the number one enemy, not only of the West, but at this time also of the Soviet Union, in this very sensitive geostrategic region with all the oil reserves. So once Iraq, Saddam Hussein's regime in 1980, decided to go to war with Iran, Saddam Hussein got support from all over the world, and we, the West, mainly Germany and the U.S. and the West, to a lesser extent France and Britain, and in the East, the Soviet Union armed up Saddam Hussein with everything he could possibly want: chemical weapons, biological weapons technology, nuclear weapons, conventional weapons, in order to help him to win the war against Iran. This is the political context. And in this in the course of roughly 12 to 15 years, so between 1976 and 1990, he got everything he wanted without any limitations, even though we did have international treaties banning any cooperation in the field of nuclear weapons. This was since 1976 because we have the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which has been signed and ratified by all Western powers and the Soviet Union. And we have the ban on production and storage and certainly use, and also the trade with biological weapons stemming from 1972. Despite these international legal obligations, we gave everything to Saddam Hussein he wanted.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the kinds of weaponry and the corporations involved. And let's start with the United States. Give us a sense of which corporations were involved and take some time to explain exactly what each corporation was providing to Iraq for their weapons of mass destruction.
The overall picture being presented in the Iraqi report to the Security Council shows that there are 24 companies that originate from the U.S., big companies like Rockwell, Hewlett-Packard, Honeywell, DuPont, plus 49 companies which are based in the U.S., but which are subsidiaries to foreign countries, European countries, Japanese countries. So that's roughly 75 companies altogether, which pretty much matches the 80 companies from Germany. The U.S. Companies were instrumental for the biological weapons programs of Saddam Hussein. One company that is really leading in this field is the American Type Culture Collection, who delivered ground substances for the chemical weapons program, so-called precursors. Those substances you need actually to mix the deadly cocktail for your biological weapons warheads. They also delivered the technology about how to do it. Other companies like Rockwell, for instance, helped Saddam Hussein improve and expand his missile program. The original missile Iraq got was from Soviet Union, the Scud missile, which originally is a German invention reaching back to Hitler's time, the V-1, which was shot against England. Actually, the only missile that ever proliferated in the world after Second World War, it became the Soviet Scud. The Soviets delivered it to Iraq. It only had a 300-kilometer range at the beginning, or roughly 200 miles, and Saddam Hussein wanted to expand the range up to 600 kilometers, and he was able to do that with the support, for instance, of Rockwell, also of German companies, finally up to 600 kilometers, which made it possible for him to reach, for instance, Israel during the Gulf War in 1991. And then we have Hewlett-Packard and many other computer giants of the U.S. who delivered high sophisticated computer technology, microelectronic, which Baghdad could use both for its nuclear weapons development, but also for its missile improvement. We have a number of companies in the purely conventional field who delivered not only complete sets of conventional weapons, everything from the pistol to the tank and the artillery, but also machinery which enabled Iraq to produce these weapons themselves. Then we have, for instance, the Bechtel Company, based in California, company of former Secretary of State George Shultz, which through all the 80s, from 1980 to 1990, built most of the construction sites for armament factories in Iraq. And what is even more striking is that most of these business with Iraq was not clandestine or even illegal. In most of these cases, federal government agencies gave licenses very openly, whether it be the Department of Defense or the Pentagon, the Department of Commerce and Trade, or the Department of Energy, and the Department of Agriculture. And also the three major nuclear weapons laboratories in the U.S., Lawrence Livermore, Los Alamos, and Sedrina, participated openly, and again with the knowledge, support, and with licenses from the federal governments of the time, which would have been the administrations of Presidents Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr., cooperated openly with Saddam Hussein.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about that cooperation in terms of the corporations and the laboratories. Were there collaborations going on? Were Iraqi technicians consulting with U.S. technicians, with U.S. corporate officials working for the corporations? How did that work?
Pretty much like usual business. Iraqi experts, Iraqi technicians, Iraqi scientists were openly invited to the U.S. for training sessions, for information sessions. They had absolutely freedom to move around the country and visit whatever institution, laboratory, or other sensitive place they were interested in. There was no limitation at the time. Lots of that was financed by the federal government. Secondly, they could take whatever technology they wanted to take home with them, and they could very freely, for instance, order Antrax at the biological laboratories in the U.S. So it's pretty safe to say that Saddam Hussein would have never been able to develop a working biological weapons program without the Antrax he actually got from the United States in the early 80s.
Well, what if U.S. officials say, well, in part, they didn't know because some of this technology was called, as you alluded, dual-use technology, yeah, that it may have been they wanted to use it perhaps for civilian purposes, for agriculture. Can the United States plead ignorance?
No, they cannot at all. I mean, this whole, let's start with the agricultural argument, the sheer quantities, the sheer amounts of substances that were ordered by Iraq should have made everybody suspicious who had his right mind in his head. Same is the case with Germany, where hundreds of tons of precursors for chemical weapons were ordered under the pretense that it's being used for simple agriculture purposes. The sheer amounts should have made you suspicious enough. In the German case, which I have researched much, much better and back since the late 80s, we know by now also, because we had a number of court cases, that in every single case, the manager of these German companies in the end had to admit that, yes, they did know. They knew exactly what they were doing. They were falsifying papers. They were sending the materials through third countries, etc., etc. So they used all kinds of tricks in order to cover up what they were actually doing. And the original claim that they didn't know that it was meant for military purposes in every single case collapsed and did not stand once these people were really taken to responsibility. And I would simply make the same assumption for the U.S., where you have even lesser number of cases where a company or the managers were actually taken to court than you would at least have in Germany over the past 15 years.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're talking about the arming of Iraq with the expansive help of the United States government, Germany, France, Western Europe. We're talking with Andreas Zumach, terrific work he's been doing in getting this material out, in obtaining the original documents that relate to U.S. and German and French involvement in the arming of Iraq. Now, I guess while the U.S. government, U.S. government officials, corporate officials don't have a good excuse, the American people have a fairly good excuse because the reporters, the major media in this country, didn't do a good job of covering the story. So, for instance, when Donald Rumsfeld said a couple of months ago, perhaps a month ago, when he was asked in Congress, did the United States government play a role in helping to arm Iraq? And he said, to the best of his knowledge, he didn't think so. The American people didn't know, and the press didn't ask. What did the press know? What should they have known about this, and when should they have known it?
Well, they should have known at the latest after March 1988, when Saddam Hussein actually did use his chemical weapons against opposition Kurds in the north of Iraq at a city called Halabja, killing roughly 5,000 people in one sunny afternoon within 3 hours. This was an act of genocide. There's no other word for that. And even though at the time we did not have an international ban against chemical weapons, this unfortunately only came into force in 1993 because the negotiations here in Geneva at the United Nations were that so difficult. Still, knowingly arming a dictator up with chemical weapons who then is using it makes yourself complicit in this act of genocide. Even 2 years before, he used the chemical weapons in the war against Iranian forces who were superior by sheer numbers, and Iraq didn't really know how to handle that. And in this instance, as we just learned a few months ago, because some secret documents by the Pentagon had to be released, the Pentagon actually gave all the target guidance data to the Iraqi armed forces by satellite in order to find the targets against which then the chemical weapons were used. So I would claim that at least since 1986 it should have been known, and it was known in those circles who were responsible for it. Actually, after the massacre of the Kurdish people in Halabja in March 88, there was a brief period of semi-public attention because it made some headlines, not only in Europe, also in the U.S. I remember that in the U.S. Congress at the time, at least some members of the Senate and the House rose up and spoke up and put pressure on the Reagan administration to at least to some degree decrease the cooperation with Saddam Hussein and Iraq. It was not totally abandoned, as it's being claimed today. This is simply not true. The cooperation went on right to December 90, just a few weeks before the Gulf War started, but it was reduced to some degree, contrary to Germany, where even after Halabja, the companies and the government went ahead full speed with the military cooperation with Iraq. But it was public knowledge, and there were a number of investigators, U.S. investigators at the time, also journalists, who dug into the issue and found out a lot. And it was published in, not certainly in the mainstream media, so you had, in terms of mainstream public attention, much less than we did have in Germany actually at the time. And the little that has been there has been put under the carpet once the Gulf War of Spring 91 was over. This is also pretty much the same phenomena here in Europe.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about what was happening. I want to come back to what you said in terms of the Pentagon providing intelligence for the Iraqis to use this kind of chemical, biological weapons of mass destruction on the Iranians. You said that the Pentagon supplied, according to secret documents, the Pentagon supplied the intelligence so that these Iranians could be wiped out with these kinds of chemical weapons of mass destruction that also came in part from the United States. Now, in the 80s, one of the key messengers, one of the liaisons between the U.S. government and Iraq was then Vice President George Bush. He was almost a messenger to the region. Also, Rumsfeld was working in that capacity. What can we say about what these men were doing in the context of using this weaponry on the Iranians?
Well, in the, his capacity as vice president and even before as head of the Central Intelligence Agency, George Bush visited Iraq several times, consulted and cooperated with the Iraqi Secret Service, with the Ministry of Interior and Police, and helped them to improve their armament and weaponry, whatever they needed, not only against the Iranians, but also against any kind of internal opposition, be it Kurds or others. And the same is true for Mr. Rumsfeld. So they, I think one has to assume they knew pretty much what they were doing. They knew whom they were dealing with. You should remember that when Saddam Hussein got into power in the late 70s, it was with a lot of support from outside, not at least from the CIA. The head of the CIA station in Baghdad, the morning after Saddam Hussein pushed himself into power, sent a telex to the headquarters of CIA in Langley saying, quote, "I know Saddam Hussein is a son of a bitch, but he is our son of a bitch." And the director of the CIA at the Times, who is now retired, Robert Gates, 3 years ago in a television interview with Australian filmmaker John Pilger, said, quote, "We never had any illusions about Saddam Hussein at the time. We knew this man was not a Democrat, a human rights fan. We knew he was not an agricultural reformer. Somebody gets up in a cabinet meeting, pulls a pistol and shoots his predecessor and makes himself the president of the country could only be called a dirty criminal and a crook," quote end. So I think Washington knew damn well whom they were dealing with since the late 70s.
If we fast forward to 1988, 1989, we can see that the United States government had a very cozy working relation with Saddam Hussein. There are documents that we discovered that show how James Baker, the Secretary of State, was encouraging Saddam Hussein, telling him that we were close. Our president, who I represent, wants a very close working relationship with you. 6 months before Iraq invaded Kuwait, I believe there was a detonation conference in the United States in Oregon, in which Iraqi technicians, along with Israeli technicians and Pakistani technicians and Israeli technicians, were learning how to detonate weapons of mass destruction. So the United States government continued its relationship right up to that war, didn't it?
This is true, and we still have this anecdote about the meeting between Saddam Hussein and the then American ambassador to Baghdad, Ms. April Gillespie, on July 25th, 1990, 6 days before the invasion, where Saddam Hussein asked her what the U.S. government was thinking about the quarrels Iraq had with its southern neighbor Kuwait about the border, about oil fields at the border, etc., etc. And April Gillespie said, "Well, we don't care. It's none of our interest. It's not your border quarrels here. It's not our national interest of the U.S." And Saddam Hussein took that as a signal that he had a green light to invade Kuwait. We still don't know whether it was meant to be a green light by the U.S. administration. We certainly do know that James Baker ordered Ambassador April Gillespie to say exactly what she did say at this meeting, which is being documented because both the Iraqi and the U.S. notes of this conversation are identical. We might never find out because April Gillespie died under, again, somewhat mysterious circumstances at a car accident some years ago in Boston.
Now, we also know that the United States government had intelligence through the Central Intelligence Agency that Iraq was planning to use this weaponry against Israel. That didn't stop the United States government, did it?
It didn't stop it, at least not at the time. Maybe they didn't take it serious enough. But one thing is sure, once Saddam Hussein won the war against Iran and felt now to be the leader of the Arab world and made rather threatening gestures toward Israel and threatened to increase the oil price, I think this was really the most important point in the perception in Washington. There was some kind of change of mind in Washington. Now we are in late 89, early 90. I think there was a certain interest not to topple him at the time, but at least to limit his power and to somewhat put him under control.
Now, there was a very extensive investigation in the early 90s by the late banking chairman here in the United States, Henry Gonzalez. It was coined Iraqgate, and Henry Gonzalez did extensive investigation reporting on the arming of Iraq. For his investigation, he was accused of being a traitor. The CIA said maybe he should be taken out and hung for his investigation. But the material was, in fact, placed in the congressional record, wasn't it?
Yes, that's true, and I think this is part of the problem, that this all, what he did and what other people discovered in the U.S. never really got to the attention of the broader public and the voters in the U.S., and therefore this report that has been provided now by the Iraqi government to the U.N. is somewhat unique, because for the first time maybe it puts a somewhat comprehensive picture together of what the U.S. contribution, both private companies, public and private laboratories, and government institutions, has been from the late 70s throughout the 80s till just before the Gulf War. You could, as you said earlier, find lots of this information, bits and pieces there, some congressional records, some classified or declassified intelligent pieces, Henry Gonzalez's work, etc., etc. But it has never been compiled in one document. And I think it's not by accident that if you look at Resolution 1441 of the Security Council of November 9th, which is one of the resolutions that took the longest time and effort to actually negotiate, more than 3.5 months, and a lot of effort went into making the demands to the government in Baghdad as precise and binding and tight as possible, especially on the proposal of the Bush administration. But one demand is really missing, strikingly, and this was the demand to lay open where the weapons came from, and I think this is not by accident. We should add that also Russia and France and Britain and China, the other four permanent members of the council, didn't really have a strong interest to have this information compiled in one document.
Well, the weapons inspectors now say the reason that they are not going public regarding the situation is that if they go public, they will not get the cooperation that they need from the corporations who have been busy arming Iraq. Do you buy that?
No, I don't buy that at all. If this argument would have been made in the early 90s or maybe even in the late 90s, I would accept it, because at this time the first United Nations inspection team, abbreviated UNSCOM, went into the field in May 91, and they started investigating and starting digging up the dirt. So they would run into a machine part which would say Rockwell on it, or Siemens, or Thomson, the French company, and they would find a box here with saying Hewlett Packard or whatever, and then they try to track it back and try to find out how did that machine or this box or this missile piece or this shrapnel ever made it to Iraq, who sold it to them, how many have been here, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So at this period, yes, they needed the cooperation of the companies in order to put the picture together, because the government in Baghdad at this time was not very forthcoming providing the information. But I would argue that once the UNSCOM inspectors left Iraq on December 16, 1998, pretty much between 95 to 98% of all information concerning foreign contributions or supplies to the Iraqi arms program had been put together. What happened since, or has happened, or maybe is still happening since December 98, is no more than 5%. Some new companies have come into the picture during the 90s. Some of them who have resumed arms business with Iraq are some of the old companies we know from the 80s. Balancing this against the need that the public should finally know what the story is behind Saddam Hussein and his weapons, and bearing into mind that publishing the names of the companies might actually be a deterrence for the future, stopping companies to do something similar somewhere else, I think this is much more important than this argument about the need for cooperation.
I think one of the significant parts of the Gonzalez investigation, he was pointing out and documenting the fact that not only was this kind of weaponry made available to Iraq, but in the end, U.S. taxpayers helped to pay for it. Iraq was strapped for cash, so there were special loans given to the Iraqis, weren't there?
Yeah, this is true. I mean, Iraq was strapped for cash, especially toward the end of the war against Iran, even though they won it in a purely military sense. It totally ruined their economy. And in this period, second half of the 80s leading into 90, they got these kind of financial support and loans from U.S. governments in order also to make them buy from the U.S. arms market. I mean, it was a game of making this country more and more dependent also from the U.S. To some degree, it was a competition with the Soviet Union, which also tried to exert it and keep its influence with Iraq, which was a traditional one from reaching back to the 70s. Yes, you are right, and this was all kind of public money that went into this certainly has been raised by the taxpayers in the U.S. By whom else?
So the U.S. government helped to foot the bill, but not alone, through the generous support, unknowingly, unwittingly, of U.S. taxpayers. If it's free.
nation down in Florida, the nation doesn't all add up. Cause it's all about the price of oil. It's all about the price of oil. Don't give me this one about blood, sweat, tears and toil. It's all
we're talking to Andreas Zumach, terrific reporter, talking to us from Geneva. He reports for Die Tagesschau. That's the newspaper, German newspaper, and they have been doing a good job filling in what the United States left out when they essentially hijacked the Iraqi document to the Security Council regarding their own weapons of mass destruction program. Andreas, I want to focus on a very serious aspect of this scandal that has to do with the way in which people were exposed to weapons of mass destruction. When the United States went into Iraq and crushed the Iraqi army pretty quickly, it was called a major victory for the U.S., the lowest casualties in the history of a U.S. war. But ultimately, it wasn't that way. Some 8,000 U.S. soldiers have died. 150,000 of the 640 or 50 or 80,000 that went to serve are sick. There are epidemics of cancer and related illnesses in the region, in Iraq, in Kuwait, in Saudi Arabia, based on a toxic soup of blowback. The United States went in, bombed, knocked out the Iraqis, but there was tremendous blowback from these weapons storage plants. Shouldn't the U.S. have known that the Iraqis had this material and that their own soldiers and people in the region would be extensively exposed?
Yes, the answer to this is very clearly yes. They should have known that, and they actually, if they would have took that into calculation, they would have known and should have known the risks involved with that, because you had earlier experiences with these kind of substances reaching back to the Vietnam War. But, I mean, there's another element of that. It's not only the Iraqi chemical, biological weapons or poison depots that were on the ground and most likely exploded when they were hit. We don't know of a single instance where Iraqi armed forces actually actively used chemical or biological weapons against American, British, Canadian or other forces who were on the ground. Most likely some of the storages of these chemical and biological weapons were hit by Allied fire and exploded, and then the poison material was exposed. But there's another angle to that, and this is the weapons that actually have been used by the U.S. forces in this war. I'm talking about the depleted uranium munition, which is munition that is specially hardened in order to destroy bunkers and thick walls, etc., etc. You could use it with all kinds of warheads, starting from the artillery to a missile or a bomb, and it has been used with all that. There have been about 300 tons of this very highly poisoned material being shot over Iraq in these few weeks of the war, with disastrous consequences, not only for the Iraqi people. The rates of cancer, leukemia, etc., have tenfold, especially in the southern region around the city of Basra over the past 10 years. But it might as well also have affected U.S. soldiers, those who later got close to Iraqi weaponry tanks, which were highly poisoned by this depleted uranium. So this whole history of the effect of both weapons actively used by the U.S. forces, but also weapons that were in the field from the Iraqis and somehow exploded, is pretty much covered up. And the main reason you hinted at that is that my figure is even it's 250,000 U.S. soldiers who got somehow affected or came back ill and turned ill. You have about 60,000 British and Canadian forces, same picture. And there is a huge cover-up by the Pentagon and all the institutions who should be responsible helping these people and clarifying what actually happened. I note that the New York Times, at least, one of the major U.S. papers, took up part of the story on Sunday when they published a story, at least on the chemical weapons angle, talking about that there are some companies in the Iraqi weapons report of the U.N., who supplied chemical weapons materials to Iraq, among them two American companies, 14 German ones. And the story is linking it to the efforts of some lawyer, I think down somewhere in Texas, trying to bring a court case against the U.S. government, making exactly the claim you were hinting at, that some of the Gulf War syndrome might have been caused by chemical weapons in the possession of Iraq, but which originally came or were delivered by U.S. companies to the Iraq.
Is there any indication that in the initial use by the Iraqis against the Kurds and then the Iranians in terms of these chemical biological weapons, that the United States was, in a sense, looking at this as a way to understand better how effective this chemistry was in case they wanted to use it?
I cannot rule that out. I have no clear proof for that, that I could argue this case. But when one cannot rule that out. I heard similar suspicions being made in Germany here. Certainly they knew exactly what they were doing. The intention of Iraq were known. One could know that the Iraq had an active chemical weapons program. And Saddam Hussein at the time had made no secret out of the fact that he intended to use these kinds of weapons in case of war and against internal opposition. So at least guilt by knowledge, I would state, as a minimum.
When the Iraqis fired those missiles that I believe landed in Tel Aviv, where did they get the technology to make sure that they could have that arc and that distance?
Well, as far as the extension of the range is concerned, it was mainly German, but not only German companies. It was also an American company. I think Rockwell helped them, for instance, to improve the originally 300-kilometer range of the Scud missiles and extend that to about 600 kilometers and even starting to develop their own missile, the Al-Hassan 1, which would have gone even up to 1,500 kilometers. They still had a lot of problems. Many of the missiles went astray and didn't really hit the targets they were aimed at because they had problems to reduce the payload, which you have to do, and the fuel, the weight of the fuel, if you have a longer range of a missile. What we do know also is that they either were not able or did never intend to put anything else but conventional warheads on those missiles. So there's no instance known that they would have put chemical or biological warheads on the missiles.
Finally, we're talking to you. You're a reporter from Germany. I'm wondering, U.S. played a horrific role, but the Germans were clearly at the center. I'm wondering the response in Germany and around the world from your reporting on this.
Well, what's striking to me, having done the research and investigation and some exclusive publication back in 88, 89, 90, mainly at this time concentrating on the involvement of German companies, and at this time only having literally one source, which were surviving Kurds from Halabja, because everybody else would not talk and even threatened to sue us, the companies, German governments, and certainly the Iraqi regime. And knowing that at this time there was at least some degree of attention and public awareness and knowledge about it in Germany, that now my story got such a huge response in Germany. And many, many people, including journalists of my age, who I thought should have known better and should have remembered, obviously didn't and took that as a totally new revelation, which it is not, because again, I would argue, 95% of the facts that are in the Iraqi weapons report to the UN concerning foreign suppliers effects that play before 91 and are somewhere have been known in bits and pieces are all contained in the files of ANSCOM. ANSCOM put together very comprehensive files, which again are secret. They're stored somewhere at the UN headquarters in New York, and they have been kept secret on the insistence of the five permanent members of the Security Council, but also of Germany and other countries who did not want the deep involvement of their companies and governments being really become public knowledge.
When the U.S. Took this document and edited it, if you will, did they also edit out Germany's part?
They edited out all information relevant to foreign suppliers, to the arms programs of Saddam Hussein, everything. What we now have is a situation of selective knowledge in the Security Council. We have five permanent members who know everything, or pretty much everything, if you leave the possibility open that the U.S. might have taken out something before they made the copies for the four other permanent member countries. And we have 10 members who don't know anything. He don't know what the information is in there about potentially their own countries, like Germany, who will move into the Council on January 1st, and who don't know what's in the papers about the five permanent ones. Whenever you have the situation of different levels of knowledge, a selective knowledge, this is a very tricky and dangerous situation and opens all kinds of possibilities to put selective pressure on governments, which might be a very useful tool in the forthcoming weeks when possibly the U.S. tries to muster support for a resolution to go to war against Iraq. I have strong indications that beyond what is in the report on German companies, which again, 95% is old stuff, pre-91, there are some cases of German companies doing business with Iraq in the 90s. But I do know that the Bush administration is trying actively right now to gather additional information about German companies who, as of now, might do certain business with Iraq, which at least is suspicious because it could be dual-use technology, dual-use meaning civil intention, but maybe military application possible. This information is being collected in order to have munition to put to pressure Germany to say yes to a resolution favoring a war against Iraq.
Is there any indication that the same corporations in Germany, in the United States, in France, that armed Iraq are now arming Iran, Pakistan, India, wherever?
Yes, absolutely. The general pattern has been whatever is not illegal is happening, and even if it's illegal, it in many cases it's happening. And as I said earlier, in the field of nuclear and biological, we have clear-cut international agreements which outlaw any kind of cooperation. In the chemical fields, we only have it since 93, but in the whole conventional field, there are no restrictions whatsoever, unless you have national laws like we do have in Germany, which made it illegal to even export a pistol to Iraq since the 70s, because according to German law, this would have been an area of tension because they were in a war with Iran. But yes, I do have a lot of knowledge about close cooperation also with countries who are on the brink of developing nuclear or other weapons of mass destruction, or even have gotten that far, like India and Pakistan, South Africa, which was only acquired the bomb with the help of German technology and German technicians and German laboratories in the 80s. Yes, it's going on, and I think it's about to be stopped only when there are other interests that might be overriding these kind of immediate interests of companies and governments, as we saw in Iraq when there was a switch of interest in the light in 1990-1991.
Is there anything about this that was illegal based on international law? The providing of this kind of training and weaponry and technology for people to use to kill large numbers of people. Is there anything wrong?
Well, again, biological and nuclear weapons cooperation was a clear violation of existing international treaties, non-proliferation treaty, from 1976 and the ban on production, use, and sale and storage of biological weapons of 72. The chemical weapons field, we only had such an international ban since 93, but even with all such a treaty, giving somebody chemical weapons or the technologies and the precursors and the know-how to build chemical weapons, knowing that he will use it and then he actually used it, makes yourself part of the crime. So these acts of using chemical weapons against the Iranian soldiers and against the Kurds were acts of genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. There is no other description for that, and I think both the American companies, the American governments of the times, the American weapons laboratories, as well as the German companies and the German government made themselves complicit in these crimes, and they should be held responsible for that.
And where do you go next with a story like this? What's the next installment?
We are still trying to find out right now what is going on with Weapons Corporation right now, but I think it is very important that in the context of preparing another war against Iraq, that the whole hypocrisy that is this whole debate and propaganda is full with, as if Saddam Hussein acquired his weapons somewhere from sky or only construed them and produced them by himself without any foreign help, that this hypocrisy is somewhat destroyed in the public domain. I think that would already be a success and maybe stop us from doing the same again with the next dictator somewhere else.
All right. Well, Andrea Sumac, I want to congratulate you on some very good reporting. You report for the German newspaper Die Tageszeitung. And you're in Geneva, where you live and work, and we thank you for the very good work.
Thank you very much for having me on.